California Senate race. On Tuesday, LaFonza Butler was sworn in to temporarily fill the seat of the late Dianne Feinstein, who will be buried Thursday. Butler was appointed to the Senate by California Governor Gavin Newsom, sworn in by Vice President Kamala Harris.
Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely, without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office upon which you are about to enter, to help you God?
I will.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
LaFonza Butler becomes the first openly lesbian black senator, just the third black woman to serve in the Senate in U.S. history. Former labor leader, service employees, international union, head of home health care workers in California. Up until this week, she was the president of Emily's List, which helps elect pro-abortion Democratic women to public office. Despite her union background, Butler more recently advised Uber as it fought the California law requiring app companies to grant workers employee benefits. And of course, as you are, Congressman Khanna, the campaign co-chair of Barbara Lee's race for the Senate. She openly campaigned to be able to be temporarily in that seat, even as she ran for the Senate. And people felt there was a kind of ABB campaign, perhaps led by Nancy Pelosi, or anyone but Barbara, to replace Dianne Feinstein. Your thoughts?
Well, I was disappointed with the governor's decision. It should have been Barbara Lee. I am enthusiastically supporting her. The Congressional Black Caucus is still behind her, and they wanted her. She was the person who was out there for 1 year campaigning. The governor said that initially he didn't want to appoint someone like her because she was running. Now he has said it's okay to run, but he still didn't pick her. And I know she feels that this was not fair to her. Of course, I have tremendous respect for Senator Butler, for her life story, for what her appointment means to the LGBTQ community and to African-American women. But it is really unfortunate what happened with Barbara Lee. And I think this just will fuel her to run a more spirited campaign. And I've seen so much support for her among the grassroots across the state of California.
And if Senator Butler decides not to be just a caretaker, but actually throw her hat in the ring for the race, how do you think that will affect the race next year?
Well, Senator Butler would be a formidable candidate. I mean, I know she has supported and helped so many women get elected. She obviously will be able to raise resources. She's a sitting United States senator, and she's a very talented person. But Barbara Lee, in my view, will still prevail. And the reason is that she has the support of progressives and her colleagues in the Congressional Black Caucus and elected officials across the state of California because of her record. She has spent decades advocating against war, advocating against a blank check for George Bush in Afghanistan when every other member gave Bush that blank check, arguing against the war in Iraq, arguing for Medicare for All and as an original co-sponsor. She has a record that speaks volumes for the type of country we need to be. And so my enthusiastic support is with her. And I know many people are genuinely empathetic to what happened to her. They feel that she was not treated fairly.
On another note, but sticking with the Senate, though you are a Congress member, this latest news that Maryland Senator Ben Cardin, who is the new chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, to replace Bob Menendez, who was just indicted for corruption, for bribery, with some New Jersey businessmen and to support the Egyptian government. Senator Cardin has announced he's blocking all $235 million in U.S. military aid to Egypt, citing human rights concerns. Are you calling for Menendez overall to resign, not just step down, which he has, from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and your response to Cardin's move right now?
I have called for Senator Menendez to resign, as has Senator Cory Booker and so many of my colleagues in New Jersey. I believe that would be the right thing to do, given the extraordinary responsibilities of being a senator and given the serious allegations against him. I also have been a strong advocate for human rights in Egypt, and have said that we at least need to make our aid conditional on the release of political prisoners. This is something that I want to study in terms of the consequences of stopping the aid. But in terms of a line saying that we have to pay more attention to the human rights situation in Egypt and can't just have unconditional resources, I applaud Senator Cardin for that. We'll be working with colleagues to figure out the best path to make sure that human rights in Egypt are uplifted.
And Congressman, I wanted to ask you about another crisis that's been much in the news domestically here, the issue of the surge of migrants that are being sent from the border to the northern cities, to California, to Denver, to New York, to Chicago. Governor Pritzker of Illinois sent a very critical letter this week to President Biden, saying the federal government hasn't done enough to help the cities deal with the humanitarian assistance needed for these migrants. I'm wondering your thoughts on what the Biden administration has been doing and what it could do.
Well, it's a very sad situation. First of all, we have to understand the conditions of these migrants are coming. I have heard from colleagues stories about young boys talking about their mothers being raped on the journey over to the United States. These are often asylum seekers fleeing persecution. And America has always welcomed people who have fled persecution from other countries. It's also important to recognize that the number of undocumented in America has stayed relatively the same, because a lot of people are also leaving back to Mexico and other countries who were undocumented. It stayed at around 11 to 12 million. But we know the solution in terms of comprehensive immigration reform. We know we need more immigration judges at the border to make determinations about who has legitimate asylum claims. We know we need these asylum seekers, once they're in the United States, to be able to work. I mean, it makes no sense to have them spending time in the United States, waiting for their formal hearings, not being able to work. And we know that there are comprehensive border security provisions that keep the border secure and orderly while recognizing people's human rights and right to asylum. The Democrats have been proposing this for years. That is the solution that we need. And my hope is that the humanitarian crisis that the border represents motivates Americans to get serious about a solution.
Congressmember O'Connor, we want to thank you for being with us, Democrat of California, Silicon Valley, Deputy Whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Next up, the U.N. Security Council votes to deploy a U.S.-backed, Kenyan-led multinational armed force to Haiti in the first deployment of international forces to Haiti in nearly 20 years. Back in a minute.
Paraíso de todo y cada uno.
Haiti by Le Shlushu. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The UN Security Council voted Monday to deploy a U.S.-backed, Kenyan-led multinational armed force to Haiti as the island nation combats worsening gang violence. The intervention, which came at the repeated request of Haiti's unelected Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, marks the first deployment of international security forces to Haiti in nearly 20 years. The proposal received 13 votes in favor, with Russia and China abstaining. The resolution was drafted by the United States and Ecuador, allowing foreign troops to remain in Haiti for 1 year with a review after 9 months. The Biden administration pledged at least $100 million to fund the operation. This is the U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the United Nations, Jeffrey De Laurentiis.
This mission comes at the request of the Haitian government and Haitian civil society to address the insecurity and dire humanitarian crisis the country has faced for far too long. The deployment of this mission will help to support Haiti's critical near-term needs and to foster the security conditions necessary for the country to advance long-term stability.
Kenya had previously offered to contribute 1,000 police officers. The Bahamas, Jamaica, and Antigua and Barbuda have also vowed to send forces. Many Haitians have opposed the move due to the disastrous history of UN, U.S., and foreign interventions in Haiti. Nearly 20 years ago, the U.S. led a coup to oust Haiti's democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. More recently, a UN mission left behind an outbreak of cholera that killed some 10,000 people in Haiti. UN officials were also accused of widespread sexual violence, including the abuse of children. Amnesty International's voiced concerns about the intervention, and Kenyan-led armed forces recently citing Kenya's continued unlawful use of force against protesters. Meanwhile, peace activists have denounced the move as a U.S.-led invasion. In 2021, the U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti resigned to protest the Biden administration's policies in Haiti. In his resignation letter, the longtime diplomat Daniel Foote wrote, "What our Haitian friends really want and need is the opportunity to chart their own course without international puppeteering and favored candidates, but with genuine support for that course." We're joined now by two guests. Monique Kleska is Haitian pro-democracy advocate, usually based in Port-au-Prince. She's joining us from Miami. She worked for many years with the UN, including at UNICEF in Haiti for 15 years. And in Irvine, California, we're joined by Mamira Prosper. She's an assistant professor of global and international studies at the University of California, Irvine. She's also the international coordinator for Community Movement Builders and the co-host of the podcast Haiti, Our Revolution Continues. Mamira Prosper, let's begin with you. Can you respond to the UN Security Council voting to send an armed intervention force to Haiti?
Yes, thank you, Amy. As you said in your introduction, this is not the first time that the Security Council has voted to send what Haitians are calling, right, an occupation force into Haiti, a multinational one at that. In 2004, as you mentioned, after the coup, as you said, the U.S.-backed coup against democratically elected Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the president, the Security Council voted for the United Nations to send in troops that were led at that moment by the Brazilian army, about 5,000 troops. And you already started listing the record of this mission that took place between 2004 and 2017. So we're talking about 13 years of history here and of human rights violations. When the UN troops came in, the first thing they did was attack supporters of the president that had just experienced a coup. They followed up over the 13 years with several lynchings of different people in the population throughout the country. As you mentioned, there were too many cases of rape of women and also children, including boys and girls. And there are still feminist groups in Haiti, different social movement organizations, different members of the civil society attempting to bring these people to justice. They fathered too many children and left behind. And as we know, UN troops have immunity, so they have not been able to be brought to justice for their acts against Haitian population. As you mentioned also, troops were increased in 2010 after the earthquake, and that ended up leading to a cholera outbreak. And I just want to say specifically, because troops defecated in clean water sources that Haitians were using to do a number of things, including drink and to cook with, right? So this is a complete disregard for Haitian dignity, and this led to 10,000 deaths, and today Haiti is still fighting cholera outbreaks. And when the UN troops arrived, what they did was secure certain multinational assets throughout the country rather than coming in to actually provide so-called stability. And we see that there are about, you know, $7 billion and more were spent during this time that the UN was in Haiti. And yet we do not see any sort of positive impact of these troops, of this mission in Haiti today. And of course, the troops have since dwindled, and now we have a more political UN mission in Haiti that's supposed to organize elections. However, again, what we've seen, the UN serve as a cover for fraudulent elections that led to the establishment of the party that is currently in power in its third iteration, as you mentioned, Amy, led by a prime minister who also is an acting president who was never voted in by the Haitian people. So the UN has really been complicit in supporting the erosion of democracy in Haiti. Today, there is no parliament. There are no checks and balances against Ariel Henry and his cabinet of ministers. And so this is some of the record of what we're seeing the UN mission brought to Haiti. And I will also signal the fact that during this time that they were in Haiti, on the ground, they were supposed to be training this police that's supposed to be able to take on the gangs. Instead, we see 500,000 illegal guns circulating in the country coming from the United States. And you mentioned before, or at least the clip that you played says that, right, civil society has asked for this occupation. And I think Ms. Kliska will talk about that. But actually, they have, if there are factions that ask for support to the police force, the majority of people are saying what we need is the United States to control its borders and prevent illegal guns from flooding Haiti. And of course, we know in the United States there's a whole issue with gun control, and the gun producers in the end are the ones who are winning in this war against people in general, and specifically the people of Haiti. So these are some of the things that I wanted to highlight. And in 2004, when the UN mission is voted in, they have the support of the Caribbean community, CARICOM. In this case, they also still have it. We know we have Jamaica and the Bahamas who have also pledged to participate in this multinational intervention. But as I said earlier, what they did was essentially erode democracy in Haiti, and it was established in 2004, and this group, this council, continues to oversee and to operate on top of the state. And this is what we call the core group, and it's composed of course, Brazil, Spain, Germany, the United Nations representative, the Organization of American States representative, the United States, Canada, and France. And these folks have essentially been the ones who are pronouncing decisions over the Haitian people, over the Haitian state, have also overseen the dismantling of parliament. So I think that this is already something that Haitian people have experienced, this type of occupation. And what we're seeing right now, yes.
Mamira, I wanted to ask you about another aspect of this. We keep hearing all the narratives here in the United States about Haiti mm-hmm. and chaos and gang rule. And yet what we don't hear is the investment that has the foreign investment that has come into Haiti, specifically around minerals. The reports of as much as $20 billion in deposits of gold and copper, and especially of a rare earth metal, iridium, with Canadian and American companies moving in. Could you talk about that, what you know about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I was saying earlier, when we see the UN troops coming in 2004, and we see also that the Kenyan a delegation that came to Haiti recently, they said very clearly they're coming in to protect certain key assets, key infrastructures. So these missions don't really come in fact, to protect the population. They are there to protect multinational investments. And in the case of Haiti, we're talking about, right, garment industry, garment factories. We're talking about big plantations. We're talking also about mines, as you said, and all of that, right, towards exportation, not leaving anything behind for the Haitian people themselves. And we know that the particular state that's in power has already been called out for all kinds of fraud, all kinds of money laundering, if you will. And we understand, or the Haitian people understand, that this UN mission is not, in fact, coming to combat gangs. Because, again, as I said, during the time that the UN has been there, we've seen an increase in the number of gangs, 200 gangs, including 95 that control the metropolitan area of the capital. And really what we're seeing is that the UN bases, if you look at where they have been placed, they're usually strategically close to these multinational investments, these free trade zones in particular. And I'll say it's not just multinational investments. Typically, the state, this particular state that's in power in its third iteration, has helped to subsidize some of these multinational investments, right? Instead of investing in infrastructure, instead of investing in social programs for Haitians. And so this is part of the denouncement of the Haitian people, is that they understand that this occupation is not really coming to establish order or stability or to enforce democracy, but it's to protect the certain interests that are allowing certain people, transnational people, Haitians included, to become richer while the rest of the population becomes poorer. And so there are records, yeah, right, like of to, people already coming in and go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, no, I just want to bring in also Monique Kleska, who has worked as a pro-democracy advocate in Port-au-Prince and worked for the UNICEF in Haiti for 15 years. Monique, your response to the Security Council decision to send in a military force into Haiti, and your sense of what the impact will be on the civil society groups in Haiti?
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. I think this validates the criminal government of Ariel Henry, because make no mistake about it, Ariel Henry is part of a criminal regime that has been in power since 2011 with Michel Martelly and then with Jovenel Moïse. He has been in power for 2 years. And I believe in the 2 years that he has been in power, he has really managed several massacres. There have been more than 15 massacres. There have been gang rapes of women and of girls. All of this under his watch. And I say this, not only is he prime minister, but he is also the head of the police overboard, a group. So he has double responsibilities in this sense. So this validates a criminal regime. And Madame Prosper talked about the core group, etc. I want to talk about the United States that is leading this. And the United States is pledging $100 million. Imagine if this $100 million had been invested maybe 2 years ago to help bring about humanitarian situation, or perhaps the consensus government that the Montana Accord, that I'm honored to be part of, has been pushing. We have been pushing, we have been striving, we have been talking about putting together a coalition, and we have put together that coalition, and we are working so that there can be even more people part of this coalition to have a transition government that is clean, a transition government that is not criminal, a transition government that is not helping the gangs. You have stories of gang members in police a cause. You have stories of gang members saying they met with Ariel Henry. You have stories of people saying that Ariel Henry, there are phone calls that Ariel Henry had supposedly with some people who were associated with the assassination of a president. So we are talking about a criminal regime, but more importantly, we are talking about a governance, a criminal governance system. And we have been saying for over 2 years, we need a change. We need a change from a criminal governance system, from the structural system, so that we can move towards a governance system that has values, that is not into corruption, that is not into stealing, that is into human rights. So the big problem right now is the governance system. So you are with this Kenyan, 1,000 Kenyan policemen. How are they going to resolve any problem of the governance system that we have? How are they, even if you bring in 15 Bahamian, you bring in 150 Jamaicans, how are they going to resolve this? No, they are going to push forward. They are validating the rule of Ariel Henry. So today we are saying that Ariel Henry is not credible. He does not have good faith. He hasn't done anything. He asked for the troops back in October. And since then, he hasn't done anything. If we take one example, Karfufuri, the neighborhood of Karfufuri, about a month ago, people from the neighborhood went to the police station asking for help to fight off the gangs. They were tear gassed. The police actually tear gassed them. So then the gangs took over the neighborhood, burned houses. So you have thousands of people who left their homes. And what do the police do? After everybody vacates, after everybody leaves, then the police come and you have the police chief who has a helmet on and who has a mask on, etc., saying, we have come to help you. Everybody was already gone. So we have a dire humanitarian situation. We have a dire situation in which women and girls are being gang raped, sometimes in front of their children. We have a dire situation of people displaced, hungry, but Ariel Henry is not the person who can resolve this. And 1,000 Kenyan troops who say they are learning to speak French when Creole actually is the language spoken in Haiti, more so than French, are not going to be helping. What we need, in contrast, I would like to see the same resolve from the U.S. government that they have in pushing this resolution. I would like to see them push a negotiated settlement so that Ariel Henry can be gone out of there, and so we can have a transition government that has values, that is not into corruption, that is not in cahoots with the gang, that is not in cahoots with others who are pushing the gang members to work, economic sector, for example. That's what we need, negotiated settlement.
We just have a minute. Mamira Prosper, I want to ask about the migrants coming into the U.S. who are deported back to Haiti, even as the U.S. says U.S. citizens should leave Haiti for their safety. We just have 30 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, we see Biden in the first month that he came in deporting more Haitians in 1 month than Trump had done during his entire presidency. So the Biden administration has very much been deporting Haitians hundreds at a time per month since it's been established, including sending back unaccompanied minors. At the same time, as you said, the U.S. embassy in Haiti is closed until 2025 because of security issues, kidnappings, massacres, etc. And Biden now has a parole program, which is really a sort of a cover for a workers program, right, that Haitians can come in for 2 years and work, and they're ending up in Amazon warehouses, on farms in New England. And so you see that there is this hypocrisy in the Biden administration
towards
Haiti. Mamira
Prosper, we're going to have to leave it there. Assistant Professor at University of California, Irvine, and Monique Kleska, Haitian pro-democracy activist. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.